You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
From Vineyard Theatre in New York City, this is Theatre Uncorked, where Vineyard artists come together to talk about the process of bringing new works to the stage. I am your host, Kevin Weinbold. The second production of Vineyard Theatre's 2018-2019 season is the world premiere of Jeremy O'Harris's play, Daddy, directed by Danya Taymor. Daddy is a co-production between the New Group and the Vineyard, reviving a creative partnership that began 15 years ago when the two companies co-produced the world premiere of Avenue Q. Jeremy O'Harris is the recipient of the Vineyard's 2019 Paula Vogel Playwriting Award, and Daddy comes on the heels of his first off-Broadway production, Slave Play, in what the New York Times has called his breakout season. In episode 10, Jeremy and Danya talk about the origins of Daddy, how they have grown as artists since their first meeting 2 years ago, the differences between working in the theater and other storytelling mediums, and the personal and artistic relationships that shape their work today. Let's listen.
I know this story, but it's a really good story. How did you come to write Daddy?
It's so funny. I feel like it's one of those things where it's like now getting to the point where I'm like, how many times am I going to tell this story? And how many people are going to be like, that's not how he told it? Like, because I feel like there's like all these details that like come up in different moments because memory is weird. And you're like, this
Absolutely.
Is the thing. But I think today's version of how yes. I came to this play is that essentially I was living in L.A., when I first started living in LA, a lot of my first queer friends were living in and around West Hollywood, because my journey in LA was from like living next to the ocean in Santa Monica, because television tells you that like the beach is LA and it's mm-hmm. not, to like slowly moving more and more east. And so the first move east got me to West Hollywood. And I met these really lovely guys who lived between Venice and West Hollywood. And they, a couple of them knew some guys who dated like much older guys. So we were in our early 20s and we'd go to these like huge mansions. And like their partners were like very rarely home. Or if they were home, they were like hidden away in some room mm-hmm. that we never had to interact with. Like probably like staring down at us with binoculars or something. And, you know, I remember I went to a house that had, like, Jasper Johns and de Koonings in, like, the bedroom where I slept. And there was another house that had, like an actual, what's her name? God, Louise, you know, the woman, woman who became, like, a really famous artist at, like, 60. Like, Louise, and she makes these, like, mm-hmm. weird sculptures that look like spiders and things.
Yes.
You know who
yes,
I'm talking
yes,
about.
I do.
I'm
yes,
doing
I
a
do.
Disservice to myself, because, like, this is a woman whose name I know generally off the top of my tongue. But anyway, she, like, this guy had, like, one of her sculptures in his front lawn, and, like, he lived, like, down the street from Leonardo DiCaprio. It was, like, weird stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, and most of those boys who dated those men were, like, young, blonde, like Ken doll looking mm-hmm. boys. And generally like a lot of their friends like looked like Ken dolls as well. And I just like navigated that space as like the like black boy who was like charismatic and funny and like could actually talk to the person who owned the house about all the art they owned. So like
right.
I existed in like a different way than a lot of other guys there. And there were also guys there who like looked like Ken dolls and could talk about those things. But generally I was the one who was like excited about doing mm-hmm. it.
And at this time, were you writing?
No, I told everyone I was a writer.
Right.
Because it like made it like gave me a different, because all those boys were like actors or right. models or, and I was like, I'm not any of that. I'm someone who's serious. You can take me seriously. I write. I write. And so anyway, one day I met a guy who was part of the circle who like was one of the men who could like, who owned a house like this, who was like a brown person as well. Like he was like not like one of these older white men. And he was really excited by me, and he invited me and a bunch of my friends back to his place. And we all went over there, and it was like really cool and crazy. And there was like a Damien Hirst in his living room. And like, I was like, this is crazy. And he and I had like a really deep conversation about like art and like collecting. And like, I told him I like, wanted to collect, and I really loved art. And he like basically asked me out on a date, and I got like immediately freaked out. I was like, what? No, like I can't. And I remember telling my friends all the time, like, this guy wanted to be my sugar daddy, and like I couldn't do that, and blah blah blah. And then I constantly was like, but why couldn't I? And I think a part of the impulse to write this play was me like questioning like what my relationship to like older male figures was, how like for me older male figures became like were also like metaphors for like my like complicated relationships to institutions. Mm-hmm. And how like I had like, because like I had been like sort of like released from like the like burden of having an actual father, I had like a complicated relationship with like all of these metaphorical daddies and father figures in my lives, like throughout, including one that could have like existed for me in like a romantic sense. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why I started writing the play, and I had these ideas, and then I wrote all of them down as like a sort of like pitch for the McDowell Colony. And even though I only had like a 45-minute play as a like sample to send in, I got let in. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely think it was because like the idea of daddy sounded really interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so did you write the rest of the play there?
So I didn't write for like the first like month of my 2 month residency. And then like everything came to me. I wrote a first draft, a really good first draft that's essentially still the first draft mm-hmm. we have now. And then I wrote a really, really bad second act, or a first draft of the first act that was really good. And then I rushed mm-hmm. an ending. And I got back to New York, and my best friend Mitchell was like, hey, so this first act is the best first act I've read in a long time. Your second and third act are garbage. Like, please, like, burn those. But if you can finish the rest of the play, I will use the money I've been saving up to, like, rent us a place. We went to Gibney, which is mm-hmm. right up the street. We, like, had a reading at Gibney. We cast Ronald Pete and Mechie and a bunch of other people who, like, mm-hmm. we just sort of heard through the grapevine could do it.
Right.
And we did a reading, and, like, that's where I got my agent. And that's where I got, like, people aware of this play in a weird way. Mm-hmm. And it got good because my friend was like, this play is special, but make the rest of it as special as the first act.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think Mitchell Savello is like the reason.
But, yeah. For the reason that it exists.
Yeah.
And so before I encountered Daddy, you did this reading, and had you done another one too?
I did two readings.
That's right.
So yeah, so the second reading is more fraught. And this is like a reading that's like so complicated, but like basically... there was a miscommunication between Daniel Fish and I that led to me doing a full reading at the Collapse of a Whole for a lot of people. And it's like, I think it like was not, I think that like, I like overstayed my welcome in a space that was Daniel's space. But it did also like introduce my work to a lot of people in New York. Mm-hmm. And I think Daniel's maybe forgiven me now. He's going to Broadway. He's
yeah,
fine.
He's great. He made a great thing. Yeah. I hope he'll come see it.
Yeah.
So the way that I remember being introduced to the play is that a mutual mentor of ours, Evan Cabinet, was telling me about the play. And he was like, I think that you'll really like this play. And then I got an email from Ross, your agent, and at the same agency that I'm at. And he was like, Jeremy O'Harris wants to meet you to talk about this play, Daddy. And I was like, oh, right. This is the thing that Evan was telling me about. And I read the play and I thought, I understand deeply why this play was sent to me. I remember reading it. My brother, I'm from California, but I'm from Northern California, which is a totally different place. And I remember my brother going to LA for the first time and then seeing him after he'd been there and what LA brought out in him. Some amazing things. And then some other things that I think LA just... this is such a strong word, traffics in, which is like some superficial things, wealth, like how you look, and all these things started to come out. And also, I was in a relationship with somebody much older than me. And I think by the time we met, I had just sort of emerged
from
that.
You just ended it, yeah.
I just ended that. And so what was encapsulated in the play about an older artist seeing a younger artist and engendering not only like a romantic relationship, but a sort of Yeah, like yes collection, but also somebody seeing you the way you want to be seen, mm-hmm. especially at first, really spoke to me in the play and what that loosens in you and how it frees you to become the person that you actually want to be, even in a way that your friends and family can't do for you. So that's what really pulled me into the play. And then also just like how it is written scenically, I could see the play. I know it's really rare to read a play all the way through without stopping. That's always a good sign when that happens. And not only could I read this play all the way through, but it was like I was watching it. And it was like the set emerged in my head. And when we spoke, you were like, yeah, that's the set. And then when we talked to our set designer, Matt Saunders, and he came back with the design, it was like, yeah, that's the thing that's been in my head this whole time.
Do you remember our first like date? Like, yes. Are you and I going out? Like you,
I also had just quit smoking cigarettes, and you and we met at Saturdays, and you had a cigarette, and I was like, oh my gosh, I really want to smoke that right now. But I do remember it. I remember it was so exciting, and I remember just talking about the play and being totally in sync about how it should like feel and move and look, and this idea that New York hasn't. We were joking in rehearsal the other day that the only other like strong LA play New York has seen is other desert cities, which couldn't be like less like Daddy. But this idea of like trying to bring something Californian to New York was really exciting from that meeting.
I mean, I remember I thought you were so, I tell you this all the time, but you're like a cool girl.
And I love that you see me this way. I go home and I tell my boyfriend that, and he's like, oh, that's really interesting.
No, but you're like, you were just so like cool and relaxed. And I think because my plays attempt a type of sort of like, honesty, because like all my plays are like looking at something, all the plays I've written so far are like looking at something deeply inside of myself that I haven't like looked at yet, like mm-hmm. I give myself like a year to think about this part of myself, and to have a director that you meet who's also really young in this, and being young in this industry is also really fraught because everyone like is like hide things about yourself, you know what I mean, like yes. Oh, you do that, like don't do that there, or like if you do that, don't do that, or don't mention this. And like you were so forthcoming and so honest and so like real in that early meeting in a mm-hmm. way that like I told Ross after I met you that first time, I was like, oh, I don't need to meet anyone else, like she has the thing that I want, which is like vulnerability and honesty with me, which is, it's sort of crazy because that's also what like Alessia asks for. I'm like, oh, maybe that's what a thing was made. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's something really cool about that. And I wonder, you know, like when we met back then, like almost 2 years ago now.
I think more. Two and a half. It was 2 years this summer.
Yeah. So like that meeting, we went into that meeting almost like both sort of like anxiously thinking like, oh, I think that like we might be able to get programmed like,
right,
next
right,
season.
Right, right, right.
You know?
Yes.
And we were like, let's do it. Like it's gonna happen.
Yes.
And then it didn't happen. It was like a long process. But like how do you think you've changed as a director since then?
That's such a good question. I mean, I think I just have like in a nuts and bolts sense, I just have skills that mm-hmm. I think that you get from repetition, from like building the muscle. I was thinking, I did this Danai Gurira play Familiar right before this, and I was like, oh, how great to work on a show that is intergenerational, mm-hmm. that has people of my parents' generation and people of my generation, and just the things that I learned, even how those actors work differently. Like somebody who's had 30 years of experience needs direction in a different way from somebody for whose this is their first play, and learning how to give that in different ways. I think in that time I also did another big three-act play, and like the challenges, a new three-act play, the challenges of trying to mount something that has never had really a workshop or production. So I think that I got a lot of muscle strengthened ahead of Daddy that I'm glad I did. I mean, it would have been amazing to do it that next year. But mm-hmm. in some ways, I feel like I'm just a stronger director than I was in all ways. And I think that another thing that I've just gotten better at through repetition and through just meeting like the people I love to work with is working with designers. So mm-hmm. like the design team assembled for Daddy, I actually met our set designer, Matt Saunders, around the time I read Daddy. And I hadn't worked with him until this play. But I knew that there was going to be something for us. And I had this like charged, amazing connection with him when I first met. So I think that's also something, like who you know and who you've worked with, who you like to design with. Because there are some great designers whose work I love, but who doesn't work in the same language. Like I sometimes joke that I like all designers to be co-directors. Mm-hmm. I even like all actors to be co-directors mm-hmm. in stage management, because you just have this like investment in the work when you feel like you have control that I love. And I think I felt that way then, but I also feel like I can articulate those things now in a way that I wasn't able to. And I also think just in general, it's great to have some distance from like the daddy relationship in my life mm-hmm. and be able to see it and not feel torn up about it. Feel like, oh yeah, I'm glad that happened. And I'm glad that it's yeah. over now.
Yeah.
But to be able to see that distance and be really compassionate and frank for Franklin in his journey through it. Mm-hmm. How do you feel like you're a different person? There's that like famous Marsha Norman quote that like you have to finish a play in 2 years or else you're no longer the same person who started it.
Oh, that's amazing.
And you did finish this play in that time, but yeah. now we're going to work on it. It's been longer than that.
Yeah.
So that person
is so different.
Yeah. And yeah. I feel like I think I met you when I was 27 or 28. That's yeah. different than where I'm at now.
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't had a play that was like, you know, a critic's pick or like hadn't right. done any of that stuff. And I think that really changes you a lot. Like, I feel like as much as I'd already grown in like the time between the play, like in the 2 months of like doing my first New York production sure. in this one, which like in my mind when we were going into the season, I was like, they're so close, it'll be like I'm doing one long production. But no, like the sort of like opening, the like previews, opening, closing, reviews, all that stuff definitely adds like 3 years to your life, like yes. you know, or especially, takes 3 years
especially
off.
The very first time you have to go through it, because yeah. it's like we care so much, and it in somebody can judge it in an instant or yes. in however long your play is.
Yeah, and it was really fraught, and I think that I learned a lot, and I changed a lot, and it's like made me more cautious in ways that I'd never thought would be possible. You know what I mean? Like in both good ways and bad ways, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm like, I think that like I talk about this a lot, but like how, you know, part of the goal of part of something that I learned to embody was a sort of like inherited recklessness that like I don't inherit from my own family, but like that I saw my friends inherit mm-hmm. and so I sort of like stole some of their inheritance and mm-hmm. like I was like, I'm gonna learn how to be reckless too.
Yeah.
And that recklessness was both fun and exciting, and like it like helped me find like different dramaturgies to sure. like understand my psyche, but it also there's like a cost to being reckless, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And seeing some of that cost, like, you know, seeing some of the benefits and the cost of that, like, in, like, real time, in, like, a 3-week period, basically, mm-hmm. from, like, the opening of my play and the really good reviews to, like, the closing of my play and some of the, like, complicated things that happen from getting good reviews and, like, sure. also being a very, I'm, like, a person who's on social media, so, like, being yes. someone who's aware of social media, like, made everything, like, crazy. So I think coming into this process, like, not only am I not 25 any longer, but I'm also like not like a novice theater maker,
right?
You know, so I think that like, you know, you and I get to have different conversations, and I think I would have if we had done this play when I was 28, you know.
Yes.
So I think that's how I've changed, but I'm also kind of excited about that being the energy that I'm coming into this play with, because it is so different from the way, like, I thought that I was going to be able to like come into, I thought that if Slave Play, I mean, Daddy was my first play, I'd come into the world as a theater artist who like, came in like in a gentle wave, you know, like right. a sort of like smooth crashing wave. And yeah. but instead, like, I came in sort of like a tsunami
yes.
that's like now, and now like the tsunami's sort of over, and now we're in this other thing. We're in this sort of like tropic.
Yes,
like,
totally.
Like environment is like, what is that going to mean for everyone? Like, who is like, which version of me are people going to think it? Or and how, because I mean, I'm such a Gemini as well. It's yes. like, how are people going to see that both of these things exist in my psyche in the same way?
Right. And even though some of like there are overlapping themes stylistically, structurally, content wise, there are different plays.
Yeah.
Even though there's like some of the same imagery or some of the, I mean, the language isn't the same in Daddy,
yeah.
Slave Play, but they're both really powerful pieces. So it will be interesting to see if people want to put you in a box. They normally do want to put artists in a box, but how this play won't allow them to, because it keeps subverting the expectation of the audience.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
Audience.
Yeah.
And actually, the guy, I mean, it's, I hate to refer to him this way, but because we're talking about daddy, like the relationship that I had that's reminiscent of the play, he was an artist too, is an artist. And something that I come back to, and I think it's really become real inside of myself since that time, but I remember him telling me that the only thing you can do as a director is make something that you like to watch and that you are proud of. And that is something I come back to every time I have to go through the cycle of being reviewed. And of course I care about reviews because I care about the work I'm making, but I try
and
to
And your
make,
collaborators.
Oh my gosh,
I mean, that's
of
the
course.
Thing for me. It's like, I know that I have two more commissions, but I don't know that like, so, I mean, like some of our actors are like, this is their first time being in a play. And it's like, oh, I want them to be able to walk away from this play being like, oh yeah, I was in that play and it got really good reviews. And so you can cast me again, you know?
Absolutely. And so I just come back to that and like that belief in one's own taste and what one likes. And I feel like that's part of the journey for Franklin in this play too, is like coming into that knowledge that like what you imagine in your head is the thing and what you are is the thing, and that you don't have to aspire to anything outside of yourself because it actually comes from inside of you. So I think about that a lot in terms of like how I am maturing as an artist and how I hope to continue to mature, is to sort of, not that I don't care about reviews, but to sort of like make this cocoon in which work can still be made and really push boundaries. Mm-hmm. So you're not anticipating some kind of like rhetoric from a critic, so that makes you make a different decision.
Yeah.
I think about that a lot too.
I mean, I really have, I mean, Brandon Jacob Jenkins has been such a good friend, and like, cause I hesitate to call him a mentor because he's like basically our age.
I know, but I joke that he like set up my life because he introduced me to Evan Cabinet.
Are you serious?
In a different path of events, introduced me to my current boyfriend. Like he set up my whole life. BJJ.
That's amazing. Yeah. He's the best. But BJJ said something. He was like, don't let people like, rob you of your room to grow.
Yes.
It's something I really, really love, because like I can already see the world attempting to rob me of my room to grow.
Absolutely.
Just like the things that I get sent out for, the questions people ask me about, like what kind of play, like what are you doing next, or like, you know, and like knowing that like maybe I do want to write like a quiet play about like a woman who lives in Nebraska next. You know what I mean? And like how that is like so terrifying, given like how people are, how I perceive people are looking at me. But like all me not doing that does is rob me of my room to grow, you know?
Yes.
And I'm really excited to keep like allowing myself to like have a limitless imagination, which is what I felt I had in LA, especially because like I wasn't here. Like I wasn't, part of the thing I love about this play is that like it was a play that was birthed in LA. So like that's why it cost too much money maybe.
Right, of course, of
like,
course.
It's like, oh yeah, like I was imagining that like it might not ever be on a stage, and so I might just borrow a friend's like infinity pool and like
sure,
do the
do
play
it
there.
At the, yeah, site yeah. specific.
Yeah. So it's like all of these things, like in LA you aren't in like a really tiny apartment. So like I feel like your imagination can like move past the walls and into the sky.
Uh-huh.
Which I think about that when I look at Alicia Harris's plays too. I'm just like, yeah, like she's imagining in LA, you know?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I remember the first time I read Is God Is, it just totally floored me. All the things that she was boldly putting on stage without any sense of like, well, we can't do that. We can't do that. We can't do that. And like, you'll find a way.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find a way to do all of it, even if you don't have the literal spectacle.
Yes.
You can find a different way to do it. But I think that's so important not to forget that you need to grow, and you can't let other people hold you back, or else the imagination will get stunted.
Yes. You know, speaking of, I'm very interested in what for you, I've been like thinking a lot about like, what were my inspirations? Like who do I think, when I think about my plays, like who informed them? Like who is it for you right now? Like when you look back and you're like these, because like when you were saying that, I started immediately thinking about like how like Alicia's play was like so exciting to me, like when I was leaving New York or leaving LA, because like we became friends like right before I started going to grad school. And then like, but early on, like, you know, like Tony Kushner, like reading Angels in America, I think that's the play I read the most. And then like I think my language and my relationship to family came from Edward Albee, like completely, because he taught me so much. I'm also like a film fan, so like Catherine Brie was like huge for me. I like really loved this movie called Ma Sœur, or like Fat Girl.
Oh, wow.
Which is like all from like the point of view of
right, Sarah's pig.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And like it's so good. Uh-huh. And then like, you know, like obviously like Harmony Korine, Lars von Trier. Like I was allowed to watch. My mom couldn't be home all the time when I was little, so like I was allowed to go to the movie store and get any movie I wanted. And the guy who worked there was like 19 and was like, "Oh, you liked Dogville because I rented it when right. I was 11 because it was the worst review movie that year." And I was like, "I love this." And he was like, "Okay, cool. Like if you like that, like I'll give you every movie that's like that." And then I also like you know Shirley Caesar, like when I like listened to her music as a kid, like there was no one else who told stories better. Like she yeah. just like painted worlds. So I look at all those things. I'm like, oh yeah, obviously I would write Daddy.
So interesting. I feel like every time anybody asks me this, it's like anybody that I would say immediately flies out of my head. but I remember the first time I saw Romeo Castellucci play, and there's something about the way as a director he works as an author. And I know he writes too, but I'm talking about like authorship through staging and the way that he makes impossible things happen on stage, and he can make something huge. Think about this piece he did at, I saw it at Montclair, called Go Down Moses, where there was both like huge spectacle of like somebody moving through dimensions into like ancient cave times, but also he had this tiny room that he made in this huge stage where a woman, all you understood is that there was a party outside and she was coming in and going to the bathroom. And slowly you see that she's giving birth, or maybe she's having a miscarriage. And it was so tiny, but it was in this huge space.
Wow.
And just like those extremes in his work, I saw something not in person where like he drops cars on the stage, like an actual car comes
and falls.
That's
amazing.
The first play I saw that made me think that plays were worthwhile was Our Town. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, this is so boring. This is so boring. When will this end? And then Act Three happened and I thought, holy shit. I just lived the experience of the character. The play made me her. And now I'm looking back on what I saw in a completely different way. And I remember I was in high school and I just turned 16. So I drove a full car of kids to Berkeley Rep. And I couldn't leave for like 45 minutes. Everybody had to wait just for so I could recover from it.
Wow.
But it totally surprised me. I worked with this great teacher I had at Duke. And he had us do a Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz play. Mm. And it was called House of Desires. And we watched all these. We watched really early Almodovar films. Almodovar's huge influence.
Oh, my God.
Love him. I love the director of Rust and Bone and the Beat My Heart Skit.
Yes, yes.
And, oh, my gosh, I'm doing myself a disservice because he's, like, my favorite director. And then huge, there was in the town I grew up in, there was an old theater where there was an organ and they would play old, only American movies, I actually realize now in retrospect. But I remember seeing, like, Casablanca over and over and over again and things of that size.
Yeah.
I was a huge reader, too, so books have always been a deep influence on me. And just like the way that you can, less like a certain author than like the feeling of forgetting oneself in a book. Mm-hmm. And like the whole, our choreographer has this amazing phrase. He goes, erase the room, erase the room. And that's how I feel reading. That's how I felt when I first read Daddy. But I think that even more than like artistic inspiration, there's something about my mom, because she's a psychiatrist, and people are always like, oh my gosh, what was that like? And she never tried to like psychoanalyze me, but I think that the way that she's also a painter, so the way that she like moves, also English is her second language, so the way she moves through the world and experiences emotions, and also the way she paints is so visceral and so full, that I think there's something in like negotiating true emotions and true emotional experiences that really appeals to me in theater.
Yeah.
And definitely appeals to me in Daddy. Like, how can something be stylistically not realism? How can we not be in mumblecore, yet every feeling is real? So it's not sent up. It's not camp. It's not any of that. It's totally real, but there's a different expression. We've talked a lot about The Favorite and how it sort of navigates a similar terrain, even though, like, if you watch The Favorite and you watch Daddy, you might not say, oh, these things are related, but they are.
Yorgos, please come see this play.
Yeah, totally.
Do you know, I ran into Yorgos 2 times during the run of Slave Play, and I was like, hey, like, will you come see Slave Play? He's like, I don't see theater.
And
I was like, will you please see? And then like the second time he's like, I'm going to try. And I was like, I was like, oh, it closes tomorrow. He's like, I'll try.
Yeah.
He didn't come.
And I know this is might be like the not most, I mean, maybe it is fashionable or not fashionable to say this, but Ivo van Hove, the first time, first time I saw Ivo van Hove, I my world was rocked.
Who doesn't love Ivo van Hove? I was like,
you can do this. How do you do this?
Wait, if you had to guess what sign he is, what would you say?
That's a really good question. A Leo?
Good. That's a good pick. I guessed it correctly.
Okay.
He's a double Sag.
Oh, no wonder. Yeah. My mom's a Sag.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But he has a Leo energy.
But the Sag is the magician.
Yes.
So that makes sense.
Yes. And he has the posture of a Leo.
Right.
You know, he's
totally.
Like, look at me.
Yeah, exactly.
I went to a dinner party with him this year that was like really crazy. And I'm like, I'm still like, how did I get invited to this? Mm-hmm. And I've never fangirled so much in my life. He literally was like, you can chill.
But, I remember I met Tony Kushner once, and I couldn't speak. It's the only time I've met somebody and actually couldn't verbalize words.
Oh my God.
But I still remember it. It was amazing. It was amazing.
It's really cool to think about how like all of that, and this, I didn't ask this question because I was like, I'm going to end it here. I literally just thought about this because like, I was just like, Tony Kushner is my daddy. but all of our influences like are in a sense like our artistic daddies, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool to think of like Romeo Castellucci or like Adrian Kennedy or
Fornes
or, you know, Catherine Brie, Claire Denis, like how they are, Raina Werner Fassbinder, like are daddies to us, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And now we are introducing a new feature where we ask our social media followers to submit questions for our podcast guests. If you'd like the opportunity to submit a question for consideration on future podcasts, please follow us on social media at Vineyard Theater.
Should we do one of these, of these? Let's do two of these. I can't do too many Instagram or Twitter questions. But we have one from Rebecca J. Silva, at Rebecca J. Silva on Instagram. And her question was, how did the casting process work on this production?
Well, we looked, I'll start with Andre, or who is the daddy. We looked long and hard to find somebody who could help us make the show happen, but also who could do this part.
Mm-hmm.
And Scott Elliott at the New Group is friends with Alan and gave him the play. And Alan read it and loved the play. And that's how we got to him. Ronald Peet, as you heard, has been with this play since before me and since the very first reading. But Ronald is also somebody I've known for the past decade and worked with many times and love. Charlaine Woodard did an early reading of this play before Jeremy and I knew her well. And then she came back into my life this summer. We were at the Ojai Playwrights Festival together. And we had been talking about who should be Zora. And in that like fateful re-meeting, Charlaine came about. And the day that we called her to make her the offer, she was listening to Alan Cumming's audiobook in her car. So it felt like
so
really
crazy.
Kismet. And Hari Neff did a reading of the play and just nailed it and was friends with Jeremy. So that's how I met her. Tommy Dorfman auditioned and also nailed it. Incredible. And Kyun Kim, who I've known of because she went to Juilliard, and I met her when she was doing a play at Steppenwolf, and I was doing Antoinette Nwandu's play Passover there, and she came to see that, so we connected then. And then she wrote me out of the blue when she heard that Daddy was happening and said, I want to fly in to audition for this. I want to be in this play. And that put the idea in my head, and then she came to audition and she slayed it.
Yeah, it was insane.
And then we auditioned some women for the gospel choir, and man, in some version of this play, it will be done with a 20 or 30 person gospel choir, because we saw unbelievable folks for that. And it was really hard to pick the three that we have, but they are amazing. So kind of a mix of people we didn't know and people we knew all coming together to make this amazing brew.
Yeah. I'm really impressed by how quickly you were able to name, like every single person in the cast. I would have been like, wait a second, who else is in it?
No, I think about them all the time. Well, and I really believe like it helps to have a good director and it helps to have a good script, but literally the only thing you need to do a play is the actor.
Yeah.
So that is like, if for people who are starting out directing, like, that is where to put your energy, is meeting actors yeah. and finding actors that you like to work with and you share a language with, because they can make a great play transcendent, and they can make a okay play really good mm-hmm. and watchable. And yeah.
And that's to, like, the point of, like, you know, the, like, Alan coming and, like, us trying to find someone who could make the play happen. Like, Donnie and I had both already had discussed the fact that, like, you know, for a lot of theaters, it was like if we wanted to have a pool, it would be a necessity to have, like, someone who could, like, encourage investors to give, like, a pool to a unknown playwright and a, like, third unknown. Or fourth time director yeah. in the city. You
we're,
know,
we're unknown director.
But, like, you know, it was like, you know, there, like, that doesn't happen. Like, that's not something that happens unless someone who has the, like, sort of following as, like, Alan Cumming does, comes into your work. But we were very willing to be like, well, I guess we don't have a pool if the person that was going to do this wasn't the right spirit and wasn't the actual role. And I know that something that was also politically important for me is that, like, the character not be played by a non-queer actor.
Yes.
You know, like, I didn't, like, I love Jeff Goldblum, but if it had been, like, Jeff Goldblum, I'd be like, maybe not, you know, because, yes. like, I think that it's, like, there are a lot of actors who were very brave in a time when, like, bravery wasn't rewarded, and I don't want to, like, disregard their bravery in order to, like, have Brad Pitt play the daddy in my play.
No, and Alan Cumming, I mean, we've been in rehearsal for a week, but, man, he is amazing to work with. He's a yes. true creature of the theater and also deeply loves this play. And so that's great. Okay, last question. One more Instagram question from MorgXN Official.
Who I do know.
Okay. What's your favorite thing about writing for the theater versus any other medium?
I think we can make this a, like, working in the theater. Because, sure. like, I think Danya should direct a movie. And Danya already has.
Absolutely.
You've already.
Like, in, well, a way, in a way.
I don't know. Stream Passover on Amazon Prime right now. A beautiful play by Antoine Nwandu. That's, like, one of the two ways I've seen the play. But it's, like, directed by Spike Lee and Danya Taymor, which I think is dope. I don't know, for me, it's like working out in different muscles, you know what I mean? And it's, like, difficult. I mean, I think that my plays feel like movies and my movies feel like plays. Mm. And I think that, like, I don't know what my TV looks like yet, but I do know that Anya Epstein was the best television writing teacher ever. And she came into my class and she taught us a class at Yale, and she was very, I think what I learned in that room is that, like, I wouldn't be the best suited to be, like, in a writer's room unless it was a show that I was running. Right. You know, like, I think that, like, I have, like, big showrunner energy and, like, that's not a qualitative thing either. That's, like, a thing that says something about, like, the way my brain structures mm-hmm. and how certain types of collaborations work for me. So I think the thing I love about film is, the thing I love about film is, like, how many more tools you have. Like, you have access to a lot of different tools. But what I love about theater is the possibilities for limitlessness. Like, there are literally limits to what you can do in a film. Like, I found that out when I was working with Jenixa Bravo on the Zola movie, where I was like, then in this scene, this is going to happen. And it's going to be, brruh, brruh, brruh. And Jenixa was like, we are not doing that. I was like, what? And she was like, that would raise our, literally this one scene would raise our budget by like $40,000 or something crazy like that. And I was like, what? Like, that doesn't make any sense. She was like, you can't be in a car for that many scenes, or you can't do X for that many scenes. Like, that literally won't get past the line producer. And so learning those things was really interesting, but it also made me really yearn for theater. Because if I wanted to do a play in theater where, like, every scene takes place on Mars, like, there would be no budget attached to right. that. It would just, well, I mean, there would be a budget, but not a budget that's I could do that, like you said, like, just with actors yes. in a rehearsal room.
Yes, well, and I think that comes back to what I love about theater, and I do want to direct movies, so hire me to direct your movies. but the thing I love about theater is the relation of the audience to the work, and also the contract that we enter into where, you know, and it's different levels depending on the play to which the audience will suspend their disbelief for our imagination. And so we... In the theater, you get to dream into something together with the audience in a way that in film, you don't. I also love how ephemeral theater is. There's something that won't last about it. So that it's happening in real time, and every night it's different. and an exchange happens that can't actually be replicated. It's one of like the most exciting and also nerve-wracking things about being a director is once you kind of hand it over to the actors, it will grow. And so you see like, how well did I plant these seeds, or how well did I build the foundation of this house? Is it growing in a way that continues what we made, or is it going elsewhere? And so all that like precarious energy of the theater, I love.
That's it for this episode of Theater Uncorked. Thanks to Jeremy O'Harris and Danya Taymor for joining us on the podcast. Theater Uncorked is produced and edited by me, Kevin Weinbold, and created by Eric Pargach, with help from the Vineyard's associate producer, Ali Sky Bennett, and marketing director, Melissa Pelkey. Thanks to the Vineyard Theater's artistic directors, Douglas Abel and Sarah Stern, and managing director, Suzanne Appel, along with the entire Vineyard staff. Thanks to Peter Lerman for creating the theme music to our podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on iTunes. And last but not least, a special thanks to you for listening to Theater Uncorked at The Vineyard.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.